Welcome to our latest R Science episode. It's summertime and one of our favourite times of the year. That's because for a week every July, we throw open the doors and invite along the best and brightest scientists from around the UK to showcase their research at our Summer Science Exhibition. This presents a great chance to ask the scientists some questions face to face and really get hands-on with cutting-edge science.
If you didn't manage to pop along, or even if you did, but want to hear more from the fascinating exhibitors showing off their research, then stay tuned for this month's special episode on the Summer Science Exhibition 2015.
First, we're off into outer space with a team who are working on cheaper and more efficient rockets for space exploration. We asked one of their team about plasma rockets and how they might change the face of space exploration.
Hi, I'm Tom Wantock and I'm a PhD student at the Surrey Space Centre at the University of Surrey. We're the plasma rockets stand, so our research is all about ways of getting around in space that are more efficient than chemical rockets, which are kind of like these glorified fireworks. So using electricity, we can produce thrust with much higher efficiency than you can do with a chemical rocket, which means that you can go much further in space on, say, a full tank of propellant than you could do with a chemical rocket. So it's really technology that's going to take us to Mars and beyond. Our research is into low cost and low power electric propulsion technologies in particular. Because that's the sort of direction that industry is going in at the moment, is ever smaller and cheaper spacecraft. And we're going to have one of our thrusters, the quad confinement thruster, flying on Novasar, which is a Surrey Satellite Technology Limited satellite, from next year. So our work is being translated into commercial applications as well.
So what's the difference with the current rockets that we have?
So chemical rockets are really good at getting you into space. So they produce a huge amount of thrust, which means that you can get off the ground and out of Earth's gravity and out of Earth's atmosphere. But when you're in space, they're not so efficient. They produce a lot of waste heat and speed of their exhaust is not particularly high, which means they're not that efficient. Plasma rocket, on the other hand, produces a tiny amount of thrust and it's about the same as the weight of a business card or a coin in your hand. So really not going to lift you off the surface of the Earth. But once you're in space and there's no drag, you can use that tiny thrust to build up to a very high speed. Plasma rockets have actually been around since the 1960s, but it's only sort of in the past couple of decades or so that they've begun to see commercial applications and become more in the public eye. And it's mainly because of the conservativeness of the space industry, understandably, given how much money is spent to get something into orbit and to another planet. So I think this is a technology in general, plasma rockets, that is going to change the way that we do space travel long term. So it's very likely, I think, that we'll see them used on manned missions and science exploration missions in the future. The thing with a manned mission is that plasma rockets are efficient but slow. So if you're trying to send people, you might want to use a chemical rocket to send the people themselves so that they can get there very quickly and not be exposed to radiation. But the equipment you can certainly send with a plasma rocket, which means that you don't have to spend that much money getting it there relatively.
From outer space to a car park in Leicester, our next stop is with the researchers digging up modern-day Leicester to rediscover the royal remains of a last king of England to die in battle. How do they know where to look, and are they sure the skeleton found under the car park is really King Richard III? We talked to Jim Butler from the University of Leicester to find out more.
Our exhibit is the 500-year-old mystery that was finding Richard III. For many people who aren't familiar with Leicester, then they probably wonder, well, how on earth it is that you lose a medieval king. And it's not just that the people of Leicester are pretty, you know, haphazard or anything. We knew that he'd been brought back to the city, and the record showed us that after the Battle of Bosworth, you know, Henry had had his body publicly displayed for 3 days, and then he'd been buried in the choir of the Church of the Greyfriars. Unfortunately, 60 years later, Henry's son, Henry VIII, then dissolved the monasteries and effectively wiped the Greyfriars and Richard's tomb off the map.
So, how did you know whereabouts to look for the skeleton?
Okay, so we used a system called map regression, where we looked at the historical maps of the city and looked for clues within them. And we found within one of the 18th century maps a reference to Greyfriars. even though there was no sign of the monastery there, there was still the area was still named it after it. We then concentrated our search on that area and looked over the successive historical maps, and we could see that the street pattern stayed the same, and that the area still, even though it was getting more and more built up, we could still follow the outline of the streets in the area up until the modern aerial photography view. So once we were happy that we'd identified the area, the main problem was that actually, because it was so built up on by this point, of the existing space that the friary had occupied, the actual amount of space that we were able to excavate on was only 17% of that area. On top of that, we only had enough money to excavate 1% of that. So we had to be very clever, and all credit to our archaeological team. What they had to decide was where in that area was the church most likely to be. So on day one, within hours of starting, the dig leader, Matt Morris, spotted a piece of bone sticking out of one of these trenches and halted the dig and said, hang on a sec, we need to have a look at this. As it transpired, after they'd done all the other calculations, they realised that this skeleton was actually in the potential choir where reportedly Richard had been buried. And as the excavation went through, it revealed firstly that this was a man, and then secondly, as we worked our way up the skeleton, that he had a very significant scoliosis, which obviously tied in with the legends around Richard and Shakespeare's Richard III. And suddenly it became increasingly likely that this could be Richard, but not likely enough. So obviously part of what we're doing here is actually explaining, okay, so the science, how we actually then took the science we got when we got the skeleton back into the lab, what we did to then enable us to identify this skeleton and associate it with what we knew about Richard III, and put this ultimate cold case, this sort of CSI sort of cold case, and try and prove that this was the man.
What sort of lab tests did you carry out to try to identify the skeleton?
Well, there was lots of methods. I mean, we had obviously osteologists looking at the bones, looking at the fusion within the bones to look at the age at when this person who the skeleton was had died, and whether that was akin to when we know Richard died. Richard was 32, and the bone analysis came back and actually said this person died between the ages of 30 and 34. It told us, obviously, we had the scoliosis, which hinted at Shakespeare's Richard III. However, there was no signs of the withered arm or the limp. His hips were perfectly level, his arms were perfectly fine. So we're taking that as Shakespeare's artistic license. We looked at, we did some radiocarbon dating on the bones. We used the rib bones for that, and sent them off to two different locations so that they'd be independently verified. And they both came back with a period of 1450 to 1540 when this person died. The Battle of Bosworth was 1485, so again, it was within the time frame. So all those sorts of tests. And then the clincher that we always knew that would just really help us was obviously trying to find a person that we could do a comparable DNA test with. Fortunately, some work had already been done in this area and had identified one possible match in the form of Michael Ibsen. So we were able to build upon that and confirm that line. And that, combined with the fact that we'd found a male, the DNA, we found a male who died from battle damage, who was the right age in the right period of history, with scoliosis and spinal deformity. All clubbed together, cumulatively created, we did a Bayesian statistical analysis, and that told us that at the very most conservative, that the probability of the skeleton that we discovered being King Richard III was 99.999%. So we feel pretty convinced that actually we have found the last English king to die in battle, and have, as a result, been able to lay him to rest with as much dignity and honour as humanly possible compared to what he was given originally.
Next, we catch up with Megan Sutherland from the University of Glasgow's Face Facts Stand to chat about facial expressions and emotions. Her research looks at how we read other people's emotions from facial expressions and attempt to determine what the ideal facial expression would look like.
Hi, my name is Megan Sutherland and I'm a researcher for Glasgow University, and my research is about facial expressions and facial emotions and how our face displays different things, like different qualities about ourselves, like trustworthiness or dominance or masculinity, and how that affects other people perceive other people's perceptions of us and how they view us and how likely they are to trust us. It kind of affects everything in our lives, like politicians or celebrities, and why we like certain people and why we don't like others, and why we trust certain people and we don't trust others. So it's kind of really relevant to, because about how we see other people, and it's about social interaction and how that is displayed on faces and how faces affects it. So it's all quite relevant.
So what would be like the impact of your research in specific?
Specifically, our research is... it's to try show what, right now we're trying to design what the ideal facial emotions would be like, so how people show emotion on their face and how that would, how we read other people's emotions, which affects like how likely we are to react to other people and how they're, what emotions are displaying in their faces and how we read these faces, because different cultures and different people read faces differently. So on some things we read facial expressions the same as someone from like China, and in some things we don't, and how that affects like cross-culturally, and we can end up getting like certain emotion things confused, which affects communication. And obviously facially a large part of that is communication, like so when you're watching someone react to things and how they're like what they're displaying on their face affects how you're talking to them and how you'll treat them and how you'll react with them. So that affects kind of like our social interactions just on any basis.
So have you, like, judging by your research, have you, can you give me an example of something like that was like culturally different or something significant that you found?
Yeah, well, something, there's a couple of things that we've managed to find out what makes faces look more aggressive. So you find masculine faces with wider jaws and thicker eyebrows look more aggressive because they're more masculine. You'll find that most feminine faces are found more attractive by both of the sexes.
Now we have Christian Thaler from the University of Southampton, who discusses a new technique utilising supercritical fluids to build ultra-small circuitry, which should enable the creation of smaller and more powerful computing devices.
Okay, so I have here Christian Turner from Southampton University, from taking a technology smaller exhibit. So can you explain us better what you are showing in the exhibit?
Transistors are the basic components in computer chips, and they're very, very small now. They're being made at about almost 10 nanometers small. So a nanometer is like comparing a meter, compared to a meter, is like comparing the Earth to the size of a marble, so tiny. But there's a limit to how small you can make transistors with current technology, and that is about 7 nanometers. So we are very close to reaching the limit where you won't be able to make them any smaller. Computers have got faster every year because we've been able to put more and more of these into the same space. And when we reach the limit, the only way to make a more powerful computer will be to make it bigger. So what we're offering and what our stand is showing is both an introduction to how a transistor works, so how the basics of a computer are built, and then also a new technique that we've been developing to grow transistors inside templates. And by doing that, we can go past this limit and create them atom by atom from the bottom up to take technology smaller and keep evolving this.
So when you are predicting to have these transistors ready to be actually applied in our daily lives?
That's difficult to say because it's a very intense market with a lot of money already invested in it in current technologies. We are already growing materials that can be used as transistors, and we have tested transistors grown our way in laboratories. So we know the performance that we're getting, and we know that we can make them. So now it's a matter of refining it, improving the quality, and engaging with industry in the process of doing that, so that hopefully a major company will invest in the technology. And that's a step that universities and research councils alone can't fund. in the commercialization step is one that you have to have an industrial partner for.
Runoff water from the Everest Region Glacier, Khumbu Glacier in Nepal, is particularly important for many people within the region as a source of water for irrigation, drinking water, and sanitation outside the monsoon season. This glacier, as with many others, is shrinking, and exhibitors from the Vanishing Glacier Stand are trying to predict when the Khumbu Glacier will cease to provide a sufficient water supply for villagers.
Okay, cool. So, Neil from Vanishing Glaciers of Everest. So, just to describe to the listeners, what have you got here?
We've got an exhibition with a backdrop with Mount Everest and the Khumbu Glacier on it. The Khumbu Glacier is the big glacier that's fed from the icefall above Mount Everest, drops down from Everest and forms a tongue, goes down the valley. We've got some images from field work that we've done out there. We've got a big block of melting ice that people can touch and feel and get some feel for how cold the ice is. And we've got some 3D images that if you put funky 3D glasses on, you can see the glacier in three dimensions popping out at you. And we've had a lot of people drop by having a look at these things today.
Yeah, certainly sounds like one of the coolest science
very
subjects.
Good, very good, yeah.
So is this what's right at the cutting edge now?
This is, yeah. I mean, our interest stems from wanting to know about what's going to happen in the future to the glaciers. They're getting smaller year by year. There are many, many people depend on the glaciers for their irrigation, drinking water, hydroelectric power, sanitation downstream of them. And over the last few years, there's been an increase in runoff, which is great. The glaciers are melting faster, and that's brilliant for these people because they've got this regular supply of water they wouldn't normally have. I should say that this area is fed by the monsoon. And so you get strong monsoon rain in June, July, August, and then very little rainfall throughout the rest of the year. And that runs off very quickly, but the glaciers store it. Okay, so they store it and release it much more slowly throughout the year. So the runoff that you're getting now is great in the short term for these villagers downstream because that gives them these things they require. But in the long term, it's really bad news because as the glaciers get smaller, the runoff will then, instead of increasing, will begin to decrease because there is less snowfall, there'll be less melt and so on. And so there'll come a point when the glaciers get to the size where they're not giving the villagers the water they need for their everyday requirements. And we're trying to predict when that'll happen.
As part of a Royal Society partnership grant scheme, sixth form students from the Bordesley Green Girls School are working with scientists at the University of Birmingham on the HiSpark project to measure cosmic rays. With the help of scientists at Birmingham, sixth form students have built cosmic ray detectors on their school roof to collect data, which is then fed into the HiSpark website.
My name's Lamisa Salam and I'm from Balls Green Girls School, and we're the cosmic ray detectives. We're a group of sixth form students working with the University of Birmingham. We're working on the HiSpark project, which is an international project to do with cosmic ray detectors. So what we've done is we've built cosmic ray detectors and we've put them on the school roof. So working with the scientists from the University of Birmingham, we've been analysing data day and night, summer, winter, and what we're specifically looking at is summer, winter variation with latitude.
And how did you get involved with this research?
So we won a grant from the Royal Society, which has allowed us to actually do this project and pay for the resources. But if any school does want to be involved in the HiSpark project, as I said before, it's an international project. Loads of schools in the UK are actually part of this. I know there's a school in Bath, another school in Birmingham, which is where we're from, and I think another university in Bristol. But if any other school does want to get involved, I think the best person to talk to would be Dr. Christina Lazzaroni from the University of Birmingham. And also do check out the HiSpark website, which is hispark.nl.
And would you like to talk a bit about the process of your research, what it entails?
Yeah, so what we do in the project, what the detectors do actually, is detect particles from outer space, specifically muons. So the muons pass through the detector, which emits a light, an impulse, a flash of light in the scintillator, which then is, we cover the scintillator in aluminium and black pond liner. And when the muon passes through the scintillator, it kind of bounces around in the scintillation material. Aluminium actually allows that to happen, which is why we have it there. That then goes to a photon multiplier tube, which then converts the light, as which then converts the light to an electrical current, which then goes to an electronics box, which then goes to our laptop and a GPS receiver. And from the laptop, we collect this data, and it all goes onto the HiSpark website.
Could you tell us a bit about, do you know how the data on the website are being used afterwards, after you upload it?
Yes, anyone can access the data on the website. What we do is we download the data, and it records the number of counts, so the number of coincidences in both of the detectors, so the muons that pass through both detectors. We analyse these counts and see, as I was saying before, see if there's a difference in day and night, in summer and winter, with latitude and all sorts of things. Yeah.
Alongside the main exhibition, we also featured events with a variety of scientists from all over the UK. One such discussion, chaired by crime novelist Val McDermott, highlighted the importance of forensic science and how we can communicate this to the public. Let's find out what they had to say.
So I'm Professor Sue Black. I'm Director of the Centre for Anatomy and Human Identification at the University of Dundee.
I'm Professor Lorna Dawson from the James Sutton Institute in Aberdeen, and I'm Head of Forensic Soil Science there.
I'm Professor Niamh McDade. I'm the Director of Research at the Centre for Anatomy and Human Identification at the University of Dundee.
I'm Val McDermott. I'm a crime writer, and I'm only allowed to call myself a professor when I'm in Newcastle, because I'm a visiting professor. And I'm here today to chair a meeting, a session, to talk about the importance of forensic science and how we communicate that to readers, to the public, to potential jurors, to the world.
Excellent. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
One of the things about communicating science, which was shown to us recently in a project that we did with the Dundee Science Centre, was, and the project was based around a fictitious case where the participants were given some information around things like DNA and fingerprints and so on. And we got a really interesting, fantastic quote from a member of the public having finished that course. And what they had said was that they had been on a jury, and that at the time when they were on that jury, the participants in that jury didn't understand the science that was being presented to them within that criminal case. And they came back with a not proven verdict, which is one of the verdicts available in Scotland. Having done the course where we exposed them to the understanding of the science that was presented to them, they said that they perhaps that verdict would have been different.
Continuing the communication theme, Ruth Perkins talked to us about the Science Made Simple show she presented during the Summer Science Exhibition.
My name is Ruth Perkins and I'm a science communicator. So I work for a company called Science Made Simple. And my job is that I get to travel all around the country and a little bit abroad, talking to people about things like science, technology, engineering, and maths. Now, we're not doing that in a straight talk. There's always lots of demonstrations, lots of people getting involved, and it's hopefully lots of fun.
So what have you been doing here at the Royal Society Summer Exhibition?
I have been doing two shows. I have done the Bubbles and Balloons show that we have, which is for the younger ones, and we've been looking at some of the science between what makes a bubble so interesting and what makes a balloon so interesting as well, and getting the kids involved. And the other show we've done is called Who Wants to Be a Superhero? So we're trying to show how some scientists and engineers actually have superhero powers, how if the people that come along to the exhibition, if they want to have superhero powers, then they become scientists or engineers with those powers.
For the past couple of decades, there's been a long-standing joke that fusion is always 50 years away. The challenge of producing, sustaining, and containing the energy that powers the stars to make clean energy on Earth has led to test reactors becoming even bigger and more complicated to build, causing engineering delays that have led to this power source being just out of reach.
Now, a team called Tokamak Energy are taking a different route. By combining UK expertise in both nuclear physics and superconducting magnets, they think they can produce smaller reactors more cheaply and quickly than competing teams around the world. We spoke to Tokamak Energy's Chief Executive, Dr. David Kingham, and Business Development Manager, Dr. Melanie Windridge, to find out more.
Fusion is a way of producing large-scale energy, baseload energy, without any carbon emissions and without any pollution or any sort of problems of long-lived radioactive waste.
And what kind of temperatures are we talking about? What kind of temperatures does it reach inside the tokamak?
So to get to fusion temperatures, we will need to be hotter than the centre of the sun. So at least 100 million degrees, and preferably more than that.
I'm Melanie Windridge. I'm Business Development Manager at Tokamak Energy, and we're a startup trying to develop fusion faster.
Okay, do you want to talk me through the technology that you have here today?
Yeah, so we're trying to do fusion. So fusion is a reaction that powers the sun and the stars, and we want to use it here on Earth because it doesn't produce any greenhouse gases, no long-lived radioactive waste, and it produces huge amounts of energy. So it'll be a really incredible energy source when we can do it. But it's tricky to do because it's like trying to bottle the stars. And we've got gases, or hot charged gases actually, called plasma, and these are at temperatures of like hundreds of millions of degrees. And so we can't just put it in an ordinary box. We have to somehow keep it away from the walls. And so we use magnetic fields to do that in a machine called a tokamak. So a tokamak is just a ring donut-shaped vessel with magnetic coils that make a trap for the plasma. So we use this to hold our plasma stable and away from the walls. And in this plasma, fusion reactions can occur. So the fusion reaction is just the joining together of smaller particles to make bigger ones. So in the stars, for example, hydrogen joins together to make helium. And we're trying to do that on Earth as well. But we use slightly bigger building blocks. So we use heavy hydrogen, deuterium and tritium, which come together to make helium and a neutron. So that's the main fusion reaction that we do on Earth.
Oh, so 100 megawatts would be good for, well, 50,000 homes or more. We're very lucky in Oxfordshire, where we're based. We've got not just the fusion expertise of Callum Laboratory, we've also got a lot of expertise in high-field superconducting magnets from places like Oxford Instruments, Siemens, and other businesses in the area. So we can find the right team of people to solve some of the big challenges.
When you say devices or tokamak, this is the actual container where the fusion reaction happens. Can you explain quickly what a tokamak is? How does it work?
So the idea is that the tokamak is the best type of magnetic bottle to try and confine a plasma. What we're trying to do is to hold a plasma in place at high temperature and pressure.
And tokamaks are a very well-known concept. They've been researched for probably about 50 years now, so they're fairly well understood. But the problem is that they've been getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and this is causing delays. So there hasn't been an awful lot of progress in the last, say, 20 years. We've done fusion. They got fusion reactions back in 1997. They made 16 megawatts of fusion power on JET, which is the biggest tokamak in the world. But the next step machine, called ITER, it's going to be about the size of a 20-story building. So it's huge, and it's taken decades to design and build, and it probably won't start operating until the end of the 2020s.
So the challenge is to get more energy out than we put in.
So we want to do things faster, and we think that we can do that because when ITER was being designed, they thought that the only way to get more fusion power out was by making bigger machines. So they didn't purposely just try to make the biggest machine that they could. They thought that that was the only way forward. But technologies have changed, and there are now new technologies available, particularly superconductors. And we think that by using superconductors, high-temperature superconductors for our magnets, we can make higher magnetic fields in smaller spaces, and so we can squash our tokamaks up. We can really squash them down so they're like more efficient, they make more effective use of the magnetic field at the center of the machine, and we can make smaller machines. And if we can do that, we can do it faster.
It'll be interesting to see how quickly we could go from first electricity to robustly putting electricity into the grid. But it could be another few years to get from first electricity to robust production of electricity.
The origin of life is one of the biggest questions in science, perhaps because every new piece of the puzzle that falls into place throws up new questions. Who better to talk to than one of the UK's and the world's best communicators on the subject?
To paraphrase a lyric from the Talking Heads song Once in a Lifetime, a song which featured on a newly elected Royal Society Fellow Lisa Jardine's recent appearance on BBC Desert Island Discs, we asked biochemist and author Dr. Nick Lane, how did we get here?
Okay, so I'm Nick Lane, and I'm at UCL, and our stand is on the origin of life.
I work on the origin of life, but the stand brings together three or four different groups, all of whom have a different interest in the origin of life, and we all bring different expertise to it. So we have one group working on how do you start from almost nothing? How do you start with something like carbon dioxide and hydrogen, and how do you make organic molecules from that? So how do you get the chemistry going? What kind of conditions does it take? Another group is interested in the geological conditions 4 billion years ago. How can we reconstruct what the atmosphere was like then, what the oceans were like then, what the rocks were, what the kind of chemical conditions actually were on the Earth 4 billion years ago? Another group is interested in self-organization of matter. So if you bring together lipids, for example, how do they form spontaneously into cells, cell-like structures or vesicles, or in fact, they often form into tubes and all kinds of interesting shapes like that. And then the other group on the stand is interested in exoplanets, so the planets surrounding, they're circulating in other stars far away outside the solar system. The discovery of this particular kind of hydrothermal vent that I'm interested in, that was discovered only in the year 2000. So these are called alkaline hydrothermal vents. And what's really interesting to me is that you have alkaline fluids going into a vent system which is full of little tiny compartments with very thin walls, and on the other side of these walls you have the ocean, if you like. So you have the ocean and these hydrothermal fluids percolating through this micro-compartmentalized vent system. And so you have cell-like compartments which are alkaline inside and acid outside with a very thin barrier between the two. And that's actually exactly the same as the structure of a cell. So a bacterium, for example, what it spends its day doing is pumping protons out of the cell. And so it's relatively alkaline inside compared to the outside, and it uses that difference in pH across the membrane to power everything, to power its growth, its carbon fixation, but also its energy. It uses it for everything. And these vents do exactly that naturally in a geochemical way. They do the same thing. So my interest in bioenergetics and how cells work found a natural analogue in the real world that Mike Russell and people were saying this could be how life started, that it's taking advantage of natural gradients, that all cells use these same gradients, and that really fired my excitement and enthusiasm. Could it really be so? How could you have an inorganic system without any of the enzymes that life uses to do this, without any pumps or anything, without even any lipid membranes? How could that system work without those things? Can we think of ways? Well, we can think of ways. We can think of ingenious ways, but the question is it true? The only way you'll know if it's true is if you can test it in the lab, and the only way you can test it in the lab is to try and set up a reactor that answers those questions, that you can test specific questions, which is what we've been doing for the last few years, and it works excitingly enough that we keep going. We keep going, yes. So if you bring all these things together, you end up with a series of questions about what kind of conditions give rise to life, not just on Earth, but on any planet. That's the only way we can ever understand really what life is about, because we'll never understand exactly what happened here, but we can understand the principles that give rise to life here or anywhere else, and so the probability of life forming under this set of conditions. And we think that the kind of hydrothermal vents that I am personally interested in, we think they should form really on any wet, rocky planet. And so the kind of conditions that we're studying, we think we should find actually on something like 40 billion planets in the Milky Way. Any Earth-like planet which has got water and got minerals like olivine should form these hydrothermal vents. And we're looking at the chemistry in these vents. Can it give rise to organic molecules? Can it concentrate those organic molecules? Once they're concentrated, do they form into cell-like structures and so on? So those are the aspects of the stand that we're really looking at.
That's it for this month. For more information, including videos and all of the topics featured in our 2015 Summer Science Exhibition, please see our website at royalsociety.org/summer.
Join us next month for a summer holiday special.